Hi, I'm Sarah Crown, and welcome to a Haycast Extra. The New Yorker editor David Remnick came to speak at the Hay Festival on the final weekend about The Bridge, his biography of Barack Obama. Zan Brooks met up with him to talk to him about it, and also about the New Yorker's list of the best 20 US authors under 40, which was published today.
I'm Zan Brooks at the Hay Festival with the Pulitzer Prize-winning American author David Remnick, whose books include Lenin's Tomb, about the fall of the Soviet Empire, King of the World, an account of Muhammad Ali in the civil rights era, and his recently published biography The Bridge, which is about the making of Barack Obama and his relationship with modern-day America. But for the past 12 years, David Remnick has also served as the editor of the New Yorker magazine, and I'm duty-bound to get your thoughts on this week's issue, David, which shines the light on a new generation of North American or American-based authors. It's called 20 Under 40 and includes names that I know well, such as Jonathan Safran Foer and Wells Tower, and others that I've never heard of in my life before. Ryuika Galchen, Yi Yun Lee. Mm-hmm. So I guess why these 20 and why now?
Well, these are writers that we've been in contact with and have published over time. We publish fiction every week. And believe me, I'm the first person to know that lists are at best an artificial construct and maybe even a stunt. But if the stunt leads toward your reading Rivka Galchen, who you've never heard of, or Dina Mengistu, who maybe you probably haven't heard of either, then that to me, that's a great achievement for a magazine to do.
There's always a slight hostage to fortune quality to these lists, as well as being a stunt or a worthy enterprise, in that I'm guessing some of these authors are going to go on to great things and become household names, and others are going to slip off the map entirely.
Well, we did this 11 years ago, and I have to say with some pride, and I'm very hard on myself and on the magazine, I have to say with some pride, looking back on the list last time, that almost everyone has gone on to a big career to be tried about it.
So who was on the list last time?
Well, people like David Foster Wallace is obviously not with us anymore. He was probably in the category of Jonathan Safran Foer. He was already big. But look at someone like Jonathan Franzen, who you assume was already a big deal 11 years ago. It's not the case. Jonathan Franzen had published two highly avant-garde Little Red novels, and he hadn't really become the writer that he would become with the novel The Corrections. And The Corrections came after this 20 Under 40 list 11 years ago. So what's the most I can hope for? The most I can hope for is that, A, being on this list encourages 20 writers, and B, it shines a light on them so that the readers of the magazine, we have a subscriber list of over 1 million, and if 3 or 4 million people read it, will read these people and go seek them out.
Mm. Why the focus on youth? I mean, presumably it's possible to write a great first novel or a great short story collection when you're in your 60s and your 70s.
It's interesting, Zan, though. Most writers, after a certain period of fiction, are going after the novel. And as somebody who's editing a magazine that publishes fiction every week, I want to publish those writers of maturity, but it's not as satisfying to publish excerpts of novels as it is to do whole stories, any more than a DJ is not all that satisfied of doing the first 3 minutes of the second movement of a Mozart piece. You'd rather have an enclosed whole piece.
Yeah.
Because of its aesthetic ambition.
What about your own favorite novels by people that were written before they were 40? What would you say? What would you group in that?
Well, the list is very long, isn't it? Moby Dick was written by somebody before he's 40.
Gatsby.
Gatsby. I mean, much of Tolstoy is written before he hits 40. You know, people's aesthetic peaks, and this is a hard fact, don't last forever.
Mm.
The most common pattern is an apprenticeship, a period of, and this is of the best writers, of real achievement, and very often a period of self-imitation.
Mm.
And the more freakish careers are like Philip Roth's, where it's constantly evolving and you have extremely original work much later on in life.
Mm. I've been desperately trying to think of a link between all that and your new book, but actually the title provides me with a literal bridge.
Fair enough.
So the bridge refers to the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. Can you briefly tell me why that bridge is so significant in terms of the rise of Barack Obama?
Well, The Edmund Pettus Bridge is a great symbol of the civil rights movement period. It's the place where in 1965 civil rights leaders tried to begin a march from Selma to Montgomery in Alabama. They were stopped by Alabama state troopers and by vigilantes and beaten nearly to death, and it was called Bloody Sunday. The march went off successfully with Martin Luther King at its head sometime later. It's resonant in the life of Barack Obama, both symbolically, because naturally the civil rights movement is something that allowed the possibility of an African-American president 40-odd years later, but also because it's the first place where Obama, as a presidential candidate, a couple of weeks after announcing, he goes to Selma, Alabama, and he addresses the African-American community directly in language that's the language of the black church, in language where the metaphor is biblical rather than of Abraham Lincoln, because he knows that in order to win the Democratic nomination, particularly against a Clinton, and Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton have very tight relations with the black community over time, that he couldn't take that vote for granted. He had to go out and win it. African Americans no longer want to vote for symbolic candidates any more than anybody else does. They've seen that. They've been through that before. So Barack Obama had to prove himself. Not that many people knew who he was beyond one speech at a convention in 2004 in Boston. Mm-hmm. So that was a very dramatic moment and a way of announcing himself as a presence on the American political scene.
Your book is very much about Obama's, both his search for his African-American or African roots and the way he then adjusts that into the political arena. And there's a quote from Colin Powell where he says that Obama ran for president as an American who happened to be black as opposed to a black American. What's the difference?
Well, the difference is Jesse Jackson and Barack Obama. Jesse Jackson is of the civil rights movement. Jesse Jackson is a minister. Jesse Jackson has the traditional pedigree of somebody of his generation in American politics, which is to say he has a language that doesn't much change, a cadence that doesn't much change. You take him as he comes. He did not come from a generation that had access to elite institutions for the most part. And his emphases and his politics were very, very much of the movement. Barack Obama is somebody who grows up in Hawaii with a white mother, an absent black father, white grandparents who raised him for a period, and Hawaii is a multicultural place except for its lack of black people. All the blacks in Hawaii are on military bases. And he has to seek out an identity for himself in a very unusual way and finds it in the south side of Chicago. And I think because he is a translator figure, in other words, he can be very much of the white community, speak a certain kind of way and go back and forth, but do it in a genuine way, that's a very different kind of cat than Jesse Jackson. And also, it's 20-odd years later. African Americans have been absorbed into the electoral mainstream in a way they hadn't before. Not to say that America is a post-racial paradise by any stretch of the imagination, but things had changed. Bridges, to coin a metaphor, had been crossed.
When I was reading The Bridge, the real sort of ghost in the wings for me was your previous book, King of the World, which looks at the civil rights movement through the prism, I guess, of three successive heavyweight champions, from Floyd Patterson, who is the kind of the good Negro, to Sonny Liston, who is the sort of the Zip Coon stereotype of the monster in the alley who's going to kind of beat you up, to Muhammad Ali, who sort of breaks the mold and is political and charismatic and all of that.
And changes his identity and becomes something different.
And there's a really significant moment sort of about midway through your book where there's a memo from David Axelrod to Obama where he says, I don't know whether you're Floyd Patterson or Ali, in that I don't know whether you can take a punch. So do you see Obama as almost the fourth heavyweight who changes the game again?
Well, in some ways, yes. And I think what David Axelrod was communicating to Obama is his memory. Axelrod worked with Obama in a very easy Senate general election campaign where his opponent was a joke. The guy's name was Alan Keyes. Mm. And Obama won that election by about 80-20, was giving away money to other candidates after a while. And yet Alan Keyes was able to get under Obama's skin in a way that no real professional politician should allow. And so Axelrod was kind of prodding him in a certain way about mental toughness, about the need for dispassion when it comes from either criticism in the press or from your opponent.
It's a book about a work in progress in terms of Obama becoming the Obama that we mm-hmm. now know, and almost writing his story mm-hmm. as he was going along and making these calibrations. The presidency is now 18 months old, but that's still mm-hmm. a work in progress. If you were going to give a report card and look into the crystal ball to 2012 or 2016, what sort of predictions, how do you think it's going to go for him?
Well, let me first say that I think the lowest form of journalism is predictive journalism. It's also the one that blows up in your face. That said, I'll proceed. Look, any American president who can succeed in passing universal or semi-universal health care in a political system fixed against initiatives of that scale has to be at least on a pretty high level. To do anything ambitious in today's Washington is really, really near to impossible. I think right now, this summer, you're seeing him literally covered with oil. It's as if not just seabirds, but the President of the United States is getting swamped in the Gulf of Mexico thanks to British Petroleum's excellent planning and execution. And it's a shame because no president can be immune from that if you happen to be in the office. And you can argue all you want that it was a Republican administration that was fighting regulation as hard as it could, but the President of the United States willy-nilly gets stuck with it. His capacity to do other ambitious things becomes difficult. That said, I think he's put two women on the Supreme Court, one of them Hispanic. He's in the process of passing serious financial regulation, which we desperately need. The things that worry me most are headed by Afghanistan, but not limited to that.
Is he aiming to be a two-term president, or does he want to be a really great one-term president?
I think he wants to be a really great two-term president.
They all do.
They all do.
Okay, David Remnick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.